This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
It's been another great, great week with technology. Can I just have a small drone talk here?
We can do some drone talk, yes.
I've been flying the drone for the last week, and I've been taking these photographs. And, of course, the drone has a 14-megapixel camera with a lens which is 140-degree field of view.
Mm-hmm.
So have you ever seen the sort of the fisheye effect?
Yes.
where the horizon rounds and it's sort of the middle looks a little bit close? So what I did, it turned out that they had released the lens profile for Photoshop. So I took all the photos and put them in and corrected them for the particular lens profile, and all the lines just straightened out.
Wow.
And it just looked like a very wide field of view. It's actually the first time I've done that. I got fantastic pictures coming out of my drone now that I'm correcting all the images.
That's amazing.
Just had to share that. I don't know if it's good.
It's
just an aside for drone talk. And no more crashes.
And we also have a drone question coming up.
Yes, we've talked about drones so much later in the show. Actually, in the mailbag, we're going to have a question about the drone. And, of course, this week we're going to feature Tim O'Shaughnessy, who's the founder and CEO of Living Social, which is a very interesting thing. And I might talk briefly about some of the innovations going on at Stratford. We're just setting up a new academic innovation lab down at our Glen Allen campus, because I believe that education is on the cusp of being reinvented, where you have to be more responsive to what the student wants. You have to deliver it the way the student learns. And really, students learn through projects. They learn. Everybody has a different way of learning, and we have to make the academic system respond to each user so that each user has the experience that they need to optimize whatever they want to get out of education. And so we're putting together a whole program to basically embed innovation in our academic delivery system, both here in the U.S. as well as in India. We're really excited about that.
Cool.
We're staffing that up. It's a lot of fun. And, of course, this week it was a huge, huge mailbag.
Tremendously big.
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Oh, wow, the microphone shook.
It was a giant one. And, you know, I have to thank you, Mr. Big Voice. He actually, even though it's against union rules, he actually helped me lift up the mailbag this week.
He had to. We needed a hand truck to get
it
in.
Oh, I know. It was actually very, very nice of him to do that, and I certainly did appreciate it. So we got an email from Jason in Fairfax. Jason says, you know, I just love to listen to music online. He says, you know, I've ripped all my CDs and I've got MP3s. I put them in iTunes, so I play them on iTunes. But, you know, sometimes I just like to listen to other music. And so what do you think of these two options that I've got, Spotify versus Pandora,
mm-hmm.
in terms of streaming? Well, Jason, that's a very good question. Pandora, of course, has been around for a while. You can create your own what they call radio stations, and you pick a particular artist that you like, and then Pandora uses, what they've done is they have an algorithm that looks at the characteristics of that particular piece of music, and they'll identify other music that has similar characteristics. And they track about 50 characteristics, and they've analyzed things. It's a very sophisticated way to get songs that are similar to what you like, but not exactly what you like.
Right.
And so once you select a radio station of like a singer or a particular song that you like, it will give you a whole bunch of songs that are similar to that automatically. And that sort of artificial intelligence has been very nice to create your own personal playlist. And then, of course, you've got two versions. You get the paid version, which means you get no ads, or you can get the version with ads, and then you've got to, you know, put up with an ad every once in a while. And Pandora has really been quite nice. But the newcomer on the block in terms of streaming music is Spotify.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Spotify adds another element, crowdsourcing. So as you assemble your playlist, you can make it public. And you can follow other people on Spotify, and you can get a public playlist, which is actually quite nice.
Pretty
neat. Because then you can actually, you might find somebody who you like, and then if they share their playlist online, you can sort of pick and choose, and it allows you to discover music, which means, see, the disadvantage of Pandora is that it's all the same genre. You pick a particular song, it's all that same genre, but you may want to have a lot of different things, and Spotify lets you actually pick the songs that you want to listen to. You don't have to take whatever Pandora gives you, which is sort of the way that Pandora operates under their licensing agreement. And Spotify actually has more songs available than Pandora, and they've made an agreement with the artists. Pandora's got a better relationship with the artists, and they've found a way to monetize the artists. So the artists are actually making more money from Spotify than they are from Pandora. So Spotify is actually growing like leaps and bounds and may actually transform the music business. And recently, Spotify has expanded their client where they'll give you free streaming on your desktop, but they've expanded it now. We can have free streaming on your mobile devices.
Mm-hmm.
So Spotify's really different. So I actually have both. So sometimes if I want to, like, just look at the songs that somebody's listening to that I'm following, I look at their playlist, and I'll then discover songs that I knew nothing about. But if I just want to just get in my comfort zone, I'll go to Pandora, pick one song that I love, and it'll just give me everything that I like. So that's actually a very good deal. It's a great question, Jason. So I think you should try both Spotify and Pandora and see what works out for you.
May I have a sidebar?
Yes.
Pandora. My daughter loves Pandora, and I don't use either of these, mm-hmm. and I probably should. But I bought her a car radio for Christmas that mm-hmm. is Pandora capable, so now she can do this in the car.
That's very nice.
She loves it. But the thing about Pandora, while you can't actually pick you pick the first song, but you can't choose a whole bunch of things.
And they won't let you skip very many songs either.
But don't they give you a like and dislike thing?
Yes.
So you can basically weed out.
You do a like and dislike, and it will gradually evolve the kind of songs that you like. And that is true.
And if you dislike something, it won't play that song again,
that
right?
That is true. Now, what you have to be mindful of course, is that if you're not on Wi-Fi and you're in the car, you're using your data.
Data,
in
exactly.
your data plan. And so, actually, I did a calculation of, you know, if you listen a few hours a day on your data plan, you're still going to be less than a gigabyte a month. It doesn't, like, run you through the roof. Mm-hmm. What will run you through the roof is if you watch YouTube videos and you're not on Wi-Fi. That'll just blow the top off your data plan.
I guess I better have that discussion with her because we've had this problem before. I got a phone bill that was through the roof when she figured out she could do all this stuff on her phone.
And so I there was somebody that used to listen to music videos.
Mm-hmm.
And they would just be listening to the music, but it was attached to a music video. And one month, their data plan, I mean, it cost them like a couple $100s. So all they had to do, though, was switch to either Pandora or Spotify and not have the video with it.
Yeah, yeah.
They were okay.
Sure.
So just only watch videos when you're on Wi-Fi.
Now, while you're listening to Pandora and you decide you dislike something, mm-hmm. does that song stop automatically and go to the next, or you have to go through the whole song before?
No, you can skip it. You can hit uh-huh. skip, and Pandora will let you skip so many.
Uh-huh.
Until you can't skip anymore because you're not allowed to pick the songs, and the reason for that is that they think that maybe you could rip the song off
right.
and store it, and so they don't want you to be able to pick what you're going to get as part of their whole licensing deal.
Gotcha.
We got an email from Sharu in New Delhi, mm-hmm. India. I've got a problem. Everybody here wants me to go to an iPhone, and I'm basically a BlackBerry user. Now, the reason I'm BlackBerry user is that I've got these long fingernails, and they're just perfect for that little BlackBerry keyboard. And when I go with the iPhone, and I try to tap my fingernails on the screen, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I can't use the iPhone, yet so many features of the iPhone I like. Are there any workarounds for this? Because, you know, BlackBerry is kind of like yesterday's story, and I'd like to be with today's story. Thanks. Love the show. Sharu in New Delhi. Well, Sharu, there's good news for you.
Uh-huh.
They have fingernail-shaped stylus that is manicure-friendly. And I know in New Delhi, everybody decorates like artwork on their fingernails.
Yes.
It's like the in thing. Now, I do not put artwork on my fingernails when I go to New Delhi, Jim.
No,
I
just I'm glad to hear
I just
that.
Want you to know that.
Do you
that.
Get any of the henna tattoos while you're over there?
No. I get no henna tattoos at all. I may fly my drone, but, you know, and I'm not really...
I may never see you again.
I'm not really certain how that's going to work out, but I'll report back if I'm not arrested. So the company is called Elektra Nails, E-L-E-K-T-R-A Nails, Elektra Nails, and they make false fingernails that have a capacitive tip so they can use them on your smartphone or tablet just like a stylus. Now, if you have fingernails that extend beyond your fingertip and have ever used a resistive touch screen, you know that an index nail can provide a lot more accuracy than just tapping with your fingertip. See, the resistive screen will work with the fingernail, whereas a capacitive screen won't, and the iPhone's a capacitive screen.
Mm-hmm.
So you know that the fingernail's quite good. I mean, of course, if you use the BlackBerry, Sheroo, as you do, you know that the fingernail is quite good. So they've created a little capacitor at the tip of the fingernail, the false fingernail, which then works the capacitive screen of the iPhone perfectly. So this was created by a company called Tech Tips, Tips, which launched the fingertip stylus a couple of years ago. The nails are neutral colored so that you can paint them to match your manicure.
That was my next question. Did they come in designer colors?
No, you paint them to match your manicure, and the cuticle can be fitted to your finger, so you file them back to fit the shape of your cuticle.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want you to file back the tip. Because of course
that's where the capacitor.
Yeah, so if you file back the tip, they don't really work that long, and you can glue it on so it'll last longer.
Thanks for the safety.
And
tip.
So these are available in packs of six fingernails with adaptive strips, glue, and cuticle stick and prep for about $14.95. They're going to be available March 2014. So Sheroo, March 2014, you're going to be able to solve your problem and get an iPhone with capacitive-tipped fingernails.
So basically, if a lady is going for a manicure, she could glue these things on, right?
Yeah.
And then have them painted.
That's exactly right.
Oh.
So it looks just like your regular fingernails.
That's pretty cool.
So that is actually not a bad idea, Jim. I am not, however, going to get that because that just isn't my style.
I was going to say this is a product neither of us will ever use.
That's right. We got an email from June in Arlington.
Mm-hmm.
Dear Dr. Schertz, you know, I've heard all your drone talk. Now, I'm kind of involved with DOD kind of stuff. And I've heard about, like, drone swarms. Not just a single one, but swarms of drones that communicate. Are there any kind of drone swarms that are out there just for the consumer market? Because I'm really waiting for you to come in someday with your swarm of like 10 drones and have them drive, you know, fly around the place. Well,
uh-huh.
June, I'm really just into one drone so far, quadcopter, but you know, I'm always open for a swarm of drones. And actually, you are kind of keeping up with the trends of what's going on. There are robot swarms that have been used by rescue teams in remote locations to give first responders a communications network to keep them in contact. Phil Mancini, who's a detective at the Roseville Police Desk, has been advising a group of scientists at the Carnegie Mellon University, and they're building a swarm of cheap, small flying helicopters that could come to the aid of officers in the country who find themselves facing off with suspects. So the crew, it's a crew of 10 rotors. They would, you know, they would move around, but they would communicate. They would act as one. So it's like you take your robot and divide it up into, and they all fly wherever they can fly. They communicate with each other. They all have cameras. So if one drone gets through, the other one signals where the other one go. And so you just want to keep them all going together through this cooperative, algorithm. Pai Zhang is associate professor of robotics at Carnegie Mellon. This is his project. So what they're working on, you see, when they have cases where there's, say, hostages in a building, and they'd really like to know where the gunner is, where the hostages are when they break in, because it makes a big difference on whether they can respond quickly enough once they get in so no hostages are hurt. So they'd like to have intelligence. And so if they could fly these drones around to gather intelligence, that's what they're looking at doing. So they're developing this technology in Zhang's lab, and it will allow tens of robots to explore different parts of a new environment and make sense out of the information that they collect. These robotic insects like robo bees, that the Weiss Institute at Harvard is developing. Have you heard of these robo bees?
No, I have not.
You've heard of robo callers, but
yes,
now they've got robo bees. Or the cyborg beetles that carry sensors on their back could be a future for foot soldiers in a network systems crawling into burning buildings to find the hottest places and using motion sensors to detect missing people. Small drones can also fly solo of help first responders, you know, respond very quickly to particular problems. Like last May, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police used a quadcopter carrying an infrared camera to find an injured person after his car flipped over in the snow in Saskatchewan.
Wow. So I
could put an IR camera on my drone, you know. In Grand Forks County, North Dakota, the sheriff's office used drones last season to check flooded farms. Mesa County Sheriff's Office in Colorado regularly sends their camera-equipped Dragonfly X6 on missions to find missing people or assist firefighters in surveying things like a burning church.
Mm-hmm.
Now, also swarms, in addition to having cameras on them and sort of getting the lay of the land and giving feedback to first responders or to military, they can also be used for self-assembly. There's a project working on self-assembly swarms at the University of Pennsylvania, where they hope to take standardized shipping containers. They're going to redesign them so that the shipping containers can click together like blocks. And you click together these Lego, these shipping containers like blocks, and you can form bridges, helipads, or runways, or much other needed temporary infrastructure. But this is the innovation. They're going to equip these standardized shipping containers with motors and with wheels and onboard computers, and it's going to let them interactively rearrange themselves into temporary structures. So they're going to talk to each other, and you say, okay, we need a bridge over there, and they'll just sort of, through self-assembly, form a bridge or form a runway.
It's like life-size Legos.
That's right. So this, and they've already got the algorithms for the self-assembly of these Lego building blocks based on shipping containers. Already got the algorithm written. They're going to present that at the International Conference on Robotics and Automation in Hong Kong in June 2014. So there's actually this whole drone thing, and distributed processing and collection of drones is going to have a huge impact going forward.
Cool.
Actually, that was a great question.
Yeah, that was
really insightful. That was part of the trends that are going on here.
Mm-hmm.
Let me.
You have to excuse us because the mailbag is just so full.
It is actually.
There's paper all over the
place.
So we
got an email from Suresh in India.
Mm-hmm.
So I've heard a lot about education as a changing force in countries such as mine, India. What do you see as some really exciting tech trends in education in developing countries? Well, Suresh, that was actually a great question because we monitor these tech trends in developing countries because many of the things that work there are really indicators of innovative changes that we could make in the Stratford curriculum. So we really monitor this stuff. So actually there is something called India's Barefoot College, which is really quite innovative. In India's Barefoot College, they started out going into some of these small villages and teaching the villagers there who really didn't have a formal education to do complicated things like solar engineering or like electronics. And they have found that they are able to mentor these folks so that they can actually do very significant things to help their village, you know, develop a technical infrastructure. So, for instance, and now what they've done with the India's Barefoot College, they're now going global, and they're helping other countries do it. So let me talk about one of the most recent projects that they've got. For instance, there was this woman, Florentine, in the Santa Teresa village down in Belize. And now she used to just, you know, she used to basically farm. She'd earn about a dollar a day, and every night it was dark because there was actually no electricity in her village. She was in a remote village in Belize. Now she's actually setting up solar panels with LED lighting for her village. So now she's lighting the village on her own, and she's got the technology to do it. Now she's from a remote village, and she was one of a class of 37 women who were trained in solar engineering at Telonia India's Barefoot College. Telonia is a small city in one of the districts of India.
Mm-hmm.
Now, her son actually heard about the program that was run by the Barefoot College, and he said, look, Mom, you ought to go get onto it. And so she looked up Telonia in the encyclopedia to find out where it was. She didn't know where India was, and she found out where India was. And so she applied for the program. And so they're looking for women in villages such as Santa Teresa in Belize to go to train for solar engineering jobs or other engineering jobs. Now this Barefoot College was formed in Telonia by a young social worker from Delhi, Sanjit Bunker Roy, and its roots is in grafting. It basically has a mission of grafting formal urban knowledge, like we learn in school, to the wisdom of the rural areas. And it's geared towards self-sustainability. They want to teach them things that make them more self-sustainable. Now, the college started the solar program back in the 1990s to provide electricity in the remote areas and in isolated parts of India. And now, many, many cities are now electrified in India using this solar power. Then the program went public, and they wanted to replicate it in other places. They actually expanded to Africa and the Middle East. Now, as part of the South-South Cooperative Program, the Indian government's Ministry of External Affairs helps women participate in the program by providing airfare and part of the fee for the training course in Telonia. Now, the local village from Belize, they had to select an older and uneducated woman to travel to India for 6 months to learn this. Now, the women start from scratch. They identify the color code. They use sign language. They actually, by the time they through the six-month program, they know how to handle large controllers, inverters. They know how to install solar panels and link them to batteries. They know how to build solar lanterns, establish a local electronic workshop where they can carry out all major and minor repairs. So they actually become self-sustainable in 6 months. Now, it's interesting. They only enroll women.
Interesting.
Because they think women are the change agents.
Huh.
And so they enroll older women to go back who will then teach others. And so it's an interesting thing. So approximately 202 women from the villages of Africa have been trained as Barefoot solar engineers. The Barefoot College makes an investment of $50,000 in solar equipment to support 120 households in a participant's village. Each household contributes some amount toward the maintenance and upgrading of the solar system once they get the thing started. Women who are trained solar engineers get paid a monthly salary for fixing and repairing the solar lamps, and a committee headed by four women and three men remain in charge of the equipment. Notice, four women and three men.
Mm-hmm.
Women control the deal because women are viewed as the change agents to bring a country out. So that is just one example of where actually you can go to a very informal structure to educate and teach people very complicated things. So we actually are going to use some of the techniques that they use for teaching at Stratford to make education more accessible.
How did you find out about this?
Well, you know, we've teamed up with KK Modi over there in India, and mm-hmm. KK is really interested in taking what we're doing in New Delhi and going out to the Tier 2, Tier 3 cities and making a difference in India. So we're actually trying to figure out how to handle this. And languages, I mean, India's got 50, you know, everybody doesn't speak English. It's the universal language, but there are actually 50 dialects.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to solve the language problem. So this is sort of like one of the initiatives and one of the reasons that Stratford is overseas to try to do things that actually would make a difference. We got an email from Peter in Arlington. Dear Dr. Schertz, I really enjoy listening to the Tech Talk every week, and I'd like to get your take on some of the long range trends in technology. Just kind of know where, because I'm interested in sort of deciding what I should learn, what career I should pick, and some of these long term trends might make a difference. Love the show, Peter in Arlington. Well, Peter, I think one of the best summaries of long-term trends that I came across recently, and I actually agree with him, came from Dr. Henry Samueli, who's co-founder and chairman of Broadcom. He talked at the recent Computer Electronics Show, and so he had some very good ideas on what were the long-term trends, and I agree with this. The Internet of Things is on us, where everything has an IP address and everything's connected to the Internet. So an example of the Internet of Things, say the Fitbit. People have a Fitbit they put on. It's got an IP address. It talks to your cell phone. It tracks your physical activity. Another Internet of Things would be the Nike Fuel Band.
Mm-hmm.
Another Internet of Things would be, say, the Nest thermostat, which Nest just came out, or the Nest smoke detector. So people are attaching all these devices to the Internet, and collectively the Internet of Things is going to make a huge impact on how we live. And devices will be able to respond to us as we move around the house. It's almost like this swarm of drones. You'll have these swarm of things in your house. They'll sense as you walk around the house, and they'll be able to anticipate, oh, I think he'd like the heat turned up in this room a little bit. Maybe we'll turn up the lights here. And as you walk around, the house responds to you, the Internet of Things. Now, it also means privacy could be a real issue.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Internet of Things means that people can track where you are, and they can deliver ads to you that are very specifically. And it's not too much of a coincidence that Nest thermostats and Nest, sort of the Nest home automation company, was purchased by Google, because Google wants to drive the Internet of Things. Because
of course
they know what you're doing and where you're locating, they can deliver a more targeted ad to you.
Exactly.
A second big trend is wireless charging. I mean, aren't you just fed up with all these wires? Everything's got
a
different connector.
I carry a pencil case around with them.
So there are basically three competing standards for wireless charging. Hopefully, the industry is going to settle down and pick one,
mm-hmm.
because that's why we don't have it yet, because they're all fighting over it. And once we have one standard, it'll set the stage for interoperability of wireless charging, and that's going to make a huge difference. When it finally takes off, that will accelerate the Internet of Things marketplace, because you've got all these things that have to be charged up. You know, you've got the Fitbit, you've got all these individual things. So if you could just charge them wirelessly, then it would just make it much, much better. A next big trend, ultra-high-definition TV, ultra-high-definition. So now we've got 1,000 lines, 1080p. So 1080p is the current video standard, high-definition standard. So 1,080 lines, horizontal lines. Now they're moving to 4,000 horizontal lines. It's called 4K TV.
Mm-hmm.
So 4K TV, also known as Ultra HD. Now so if you're about ready to buy a TV, I'm thinking it may be worth waiting.
Sure.
I mean, why buy the last HD before the Ultra HD comes out?
Right.
So now the Ultra HDs right now, as you'd expect, have really a premium price tag.
Oh, yes, they do.
Well, see, they got four times the resolution, so they're four times the price. They got four times as many pixels. And so, and then we'll also have to have ultra high definition desktop boxes, set-top boxes. And then there's going to be a whole evolution. So I would say ultra high definition television is going to be out in the next 2 or 3 years. So
mm-hmm.
if you can hold off for 2 or 3 years, I'd hold off. But if your TV just crashes on you, you've got to do it now.
Yeah.
The next big trend, connected cars.
Mm-hmm.
Connected cars. You know, right now I'm using like my Waze navigation system, and which is really better than the navigation system built into my Lexus, because it responds to actual traffic patterns.
He drives a Lexus,
dynamically.
Everybody. He drives a Lexus, everybody.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry for the automobile sidebar.
Yeah. And so the trouble is, I've got my iPhone down there. I'd love to have the display in my iPhone display in the car system.
Yeah.
But the car doesn't talk to my iPhone. Well, that's the next thing, where we're going to have your car connected to your iPhone. We're also going to see cars enabled with, Wi-Fi, so everything's connected to the Wi-Fi. It'll be display on the screen. They'll have LTE connection. They'll have high bandwidth connections, so they'll be able to talk to each other. So you're going to see cars talking to each other. You're going to see cars communicating in all kinds of ways to the inhabitants of within the car. And so now what they're looking at connected cars as a living room on wheels, where now you've got you've got all your multimedia stuff there. And I don't know what you're going to be able to drive. That's probably why we need the autonomous vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
So you can sit there and watch a high-definition TV movie in your car and just let the car drive itself. So pretty soon it will be an autonomous living room on wheels.
So this is saying something, that the app on your smartphone is better than the Navigator in a high-end car.
It is. And the reason is because the map in my car is updated every 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the map in Waze, if they add a new road through crowdsourcing, the new road is on my map within 2 days.
Wow.
So it's a synchrony of information. What I really need is my navigation system in the Lexus to be connected real-time and download real-time data, what's going on, which is what Waze does.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I really think that the cell phone navigation systems have leapfrogged the navigation systems in the car. But then I think they're still going to merge together in the next go-around, where it'll just display right in the car itself. The next thing is, as far as smartphones, 3G is going to be dead. LTE, which is the fourth generation network, is going to be king everywhere. And you'll be able to download it up to 75 megabits per second. And you'll be able to boost up to 150 megabits per second. So you're really going to see some, really high bandwidth applications on the smartphones. And you're going to see a lot of streaming stuff. So it's going to really transform actually how we use cell phones, how we use the network, how we use media. Proximity awareness is going to be the next great marketing opportunity. You see what's happening now, like when I have Waze, they know exactly where I'm driving because my GPS is sent to them at all times.
Mm-hmm.
You walk around a store, they've got this iBeacon tracker. As you walk around the store, your iPhone is basically a GPS beacon, tells people where you are. So if they know where you are, they say, hey, we've got a great yogurt here in the store right beside you. Or you could walk by a vending machine. The vending machine says, excuse me, we've got a sale.
You want a drink?
Yeah, aren't you thirsty? We've got that. We know that your favorite drink is Diet Coke. Would you like a Diet Coke? We've got 10 cents off. So all of a sudden, this Internet of Things is going to start responding as you walk around.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be a huge marketing opportunity. And finally, we're going to see more bandwidth in 5 gigahertz Wi-Fi. See, right now I'm using 2.4 gigahertz Wi-Fi. But there are actually two unlicensed bands, a 5 gigahertz Wi-Fi and a 2.4 gigahertz Wi-Fi. And so the 5.8 gigahertz Wi-Fi has got a lot more bandwidth. I use 5.8 gigahertz to control my drone.
Mm-hmm.
Coming back to the drone. Which I like because it doesn't interfere with any of my home Wi-Fi stuff. But if I start having a 5.8 gigahertz Wi-Fi at home, then it may affect my drone flight. I may have to go to another bandwidth. But once you go to 5.8 gigahertz, you'll get a lot more bandwidth, and you'll be able to get up to a few hundred megabits per second. So you won't have to wire the house. I mean, the video can just be sent around the house without any problem. So this quality of wiring will just be dead.
That's amazing.
So that's it.
And folks,
listen, we love your emails. Send us new emails at techtalk@stratford.edu. We'll get back on the air, or we will email you directly with a response. And also check out Stratford University by going to stratford.edu and let them know that you heard about their programs on Tech Talk.
Thanks for listening to Tech Talk Radio. It's Saturday morning. We'll have more Tech Talk coming up right after this on 1500 AM, 820 AM, and on federalnewsradio.com. Stand by for more Tech Talk.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the Internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
It's time. Time to put your talents out there on your terms. Get full credit for your ideas and hard work and set your own pay. If you're ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Masters in Entrepreneurial Management program can show you how to develop and launch your business. From writing a solid business plan to financing, legal issues, staffing, even branding and marketing. Let Stratford show you the ropes and walk you over the pitfalls of running your own business. Choose from online or in-classroom courses at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner and Woodbridge. It's time. Time to take charge of your future on your own terms. Contact us today at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. or give us a call at 800-444-0804. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University, it's time to be more.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. Now, it is time for...
Profiles in IT.
Yes, today we're going to talk about Tim O'Shaughnessy. He is co-founder of Living Social. It's an extremely fast-growing competitor for Groupon in the online to offline business sector, O2O. You ever heard of that buzzword, online to offline business sector?
No, that's the first I've heard of that.
So they basically send you a coupon or something online. It drives you to a restaurant or a bar to buy something offline.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the online to offline business sector that was really invented by Groupon. Tim O'Shaughnessy was born in 1982 in Minnesota. His father ran a freight company in Apple Valley, Minnesota. Tim's the youngest of four. Now, he's always been an entrepreneur. At age eight, he started a candy business. Now, what he did, he used his $8 a week allowance, and he'd go to a store, one of these big box stores like Costco, and buy bags of these little mini candy bars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the little...
Yeah.
He'd buy a big bag of them in bulk, of the little mini candy bars. And then he would go to the Little League ball games with his wagon, and he would sell the little mini candy bars for 25 cents each. So he'd basically... So $8 invested in a big bag of candy would produce $32. So he got a 4-to-1 leverage. And so...
You don't have to be Einstein to figure that one
no.
out.
No, and so what he said he always looked for inefficiencies in the marketplace and tried to get rid of them and make a little money on the side. So this was a very successful business until a competitor began to try to knock him out of the business.
Uh-huh.
And the competitor was selling bigger candy bars at the Little League place, and it turned out the competitor was his big brother.
So I was going to say, so he beat him up.
That was his big brother said, hey, Tim, you're doing so well on this. I think I'm going to go into the candy business.
Horning on the business there.
Yeah, so his brother started selling these. He went and he found a deal to get these giant candy bars, so he was selling giant candy bars. But Tim did quite well for a while. Tim attended the St. Thomas Academy, which was a Catholic military academy there in Minnesota. Then
that's an interesting combination. A Catholic military.
Yeah. I don't know. It probably, you know, dates back to the Crusades.
I thought we weren't supposed to kill people.
I know. I think it dates back to the Crusades.
Ah, gotcha.
So he then enrolled in Georgetown University in 2001. That's how he actually finally arrived, become a local boy here in Washington. And he was a double major in operations and information management, OPIM, operations and information management. Now, to help pay for college, because he was always kind of a working guy, he started a handyman service where he would hire people to go out and do, you know, odd jobs in the house. And he also worked as a live-in chef. And so that's really how he paid for his college going all the way through. In 2004, during his senior year, Tim was involved in a class project where they were doing a consulting job for AOL. They did some kind of analysis and came back. And then they gave their final report to the AOL executive team. The day after the group made their presentation, the executive office at AOL called them up and said, we want to offer you a job. He said, look, I've already got a job. And mm-hmm. he said, I was planning to attend bar this summer, travel the world, and I've got this other job at the consulting company. And AOL would not accept no for an answer. And finally, he did accept. 2 weeks later, he started at AOL's Tyson's headquarters. Now, his mom was happy because he did graduate from Georgetown with a bachelor's degree.
Being a Catholic mom, she would have it no other way.
You know, with his degree in OPIM. Now, 2 years after going to AOL, he left that and he went to Revolution Health. This was a startup that Steve Case had started up. He was, of course, the AOL co-founder. Steve Case started Revolution Health. And he was, you know, trying to get into healthcare. He's actually, Steve Case is, you know, kind of a local boy too, started AOL, and he's like a big angel investor and all kinds of things now. In 2007, Tim and several colleagues from Revolution Health started a new company called Hungry Machine. Hungry Machine. Now, they got the idea while sitting drinking beer at the Brickskeller, which is a bar near DuPont Circle.
You get a lot of ideas while drinking. Usually none of them are productive, though.
They said, yeah, let's get, you know, I'm kind of hungry. How about Hungry Machine?
Uh-huh.
And so they split the project between a couple of things. They started doing some large-scale consulting projects for ESPN and Jib Jab, which is sort of makes these online, you know, cartoons. But then on the side, they started developing Facebook applications like Visual Bookshelf that would help you select your books, organize your books. And so they had kind of this programming piece that was kind of just fun to play with, and they had the consulting job. It didn't take them long to realize that actually their Facebook products had more potential for profitability than their main business, which was consulting. So they dropped the consulting piece and started developing the Facebook platform. And they started looking at this area of O2O, online to offline. And this is because Groupon was just making bucks out of it. They said, you know, Groupon's got something here. Let's see what we can do. And so they... And what they, you know, so they thought, okay, let's, so they thought, let's try a little bit of that. And the idea for Hungry Machine is they said, you're never satisfied. You always want to reach a bigger goal. You're always hungry for more. Therefore, you're in a hungry machine.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, so Hungry Machine, they said, hungry's really an attitude. Now, in the spring of 2008, Hungry Machine's five employees, this was spring of 2008, knew they had found an interesting niche in this Facebook app thing. They actually wrote an app that within 3 months had been downloaded some 8 million times.
Wow!
And they became the number one app on Facebook for a while. But they wanted to grow and they wanted to develop it. So they went to Steve Case, and Steve Case was willing to kick in some seed money for this, but they actually wanted more. So they went to another local VC company, GrowTech, and GrowTech added $5 million. So Steve kicked in some. They had $5 million from GrowTech on Series A financing, and they launched. And this application that their first big application I mentioned earlier was Pick Your Five app, which encouraged Facebook users to pick their favorite drinks, their favorite musicians, their favorite books. And Pick Your Five was the number one app on Facebook. Now, they decided that maybe Hungry Machine was not necessarily a good name for their company. And they decided to get into this O2O business when they bought a small acquisition called Buy a Friend a Drink. And this is where you could buy, you know, you could buy a drink for your friend online, then he could print out take a coupon in, or he could show his cell phone, and the guy could go get a drink. So you could be at a bar, you could buy a drink for somebody, and it'd show up on their cell phone. So that was kind of the first O2O, online to offline deal, and that kind of got them interested in it. And so they began, you know, coming up with, like, deal of the day and other things like that. Now, by the end of 2009, see, this time frame, in the spring of 2008, they had five employees. By the end of 2009, they had raised $176 million.
That's amazing.
To have an accelerated expansion. By the end of 2010, they had raised an additional $400 million for an accelerated expansion. By the end of 2010, they had 46 million subscribers in 25 countries. So the first year, by the end of 2008, they had about 30 employees. By the end of 2009, they had around 1,200 employees. By the end of 2010, they were up to 3,000 employees. Now they have 5,000 employees. Now, in just a couple of years, to go up to 5,000 employees is quite a feat.
Yeah.
Groupon has around 10,000 employees. Most of their employees, by the way, are just selling these deals. They're just out in the marketplace talking to people, selling, getting restaurants to get deals for deal of the day. So that's where they spend most of their time. But they have a different strategy. Groupon has more, it's more of a call center deal where they've got centralized call centers calling all these businesses. These guys at Living Social actually have people stationed in the cities where they have, and they actually walk around and they actually meet the person before they do the sale. And they have like one product where you might say get a $20 meal for $10. So you buy it and you pay for the $10 meal online. Then when you go to the vendor that had the $20 meal for $10, they have provided him with an iPad. He opens up the iPad.
Uh-huh.
He sees your name, that you have actually purchased it. And then he clicks a button that says redeemed. At that time, your credit card is charged. So
Wow. If,
for instance, you would not go to the restaurant because something else came up, you're
never going to get charged.
You wouldn't be charged until it's redeemed.
That's pretty wild.
And so Living Social provides the iPad to the vendor, so they have all the software. It's a one-stop shop. So these guys are fairly innovative, and their goal is to just expand faster than anybody else, so they can dominate the O2O space, and they want to catch up with Groupon.
Are they making money?
No, they're losing a lot of money.
Really?
They're losing a lot of money. Groupon's losing a lot of money.
Hmm.
But Amazon lost money for a long time. They think what they're trying to do is they're trying to build up the sales network in every city that they have, which, of course, is a loss leader. And then they hope that over time, that sales network will generate enough sales for them to make money.
Do you think it's just that people don't know who they are? It's a great idea.
Yeah, I think people, you know, it's basically, now they did buy last year a Super Bowl ad.
Uh-huh.
And I watched this guy talk. He was out at Deloitte giving a talk. For instance, what he did, he said they were, you know, these, when they're losing money, they have a burn rate. That's what they call it, a burn rate. So he was, he had enough money at his current burn rate to last about a year.
Uh-huh.
So the executive team got together. They said, look, we want to grow even faster. So they hired even more people. They accelerated their burn rate so they would run out of money in 6 weeks. And then it was Tim's job to go out and raise additional capital within 6 weeks in order to keep them going.
Is that how the $400 million came about?
That's where the $400 million came from. So
boy, is that risky, especially
so
these
he's
days.
Just he's, now he get this. He's married to Laura Graham.
Yeah.
The daughter of the Washington Post CEO, Donald Graham.
So he's a little connected.
He's connected to the Grahams, which are one of the top families in Washington, and is one of his major backers and mentors is Steve Case, founder of AOL. So he's well connected. Now, he lives downtown and he did an analysis. If he drives to work, it takes him, because he has to find a parking place, it takes him like 15 to 18 minutes to drive to work. It's not that far, and he spends a lot of time parking. If he takes the subway, it takes him about 20 minutes. So he bought a Segway. He can get to work on the Segway in 11 minutes, and there's no parking.
Yeah.
So he takes the Segway to work every morning.
Just take it upstairs with you.
That's right. Now, he keeps an ice cream cooler in his office to encourage colleagues to come in and visit with him and chat on what's going on. So it's an interesting guy. I tell you, he's growing fast. He's focused a lot on the internal culture, but I'll tell you, going from 5 people to 5,000 people in 2 years, that is a tough, tough deal. He said he's reached a point. He used to interview everybody. He can't interview everybody anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But this is an interesting story. Tim O'Shaughnessy, the founder of Living Social, which grew out of the company Hungry Machine.
So it sounds like most of these people that he's rushing to hire are the ones that are out in the field in the cities.
It's the sales force.
Yeah, because the rest of it.
And he's hired a crack IT team to keep the servers going. But most of his people are sales force. And in fact, we found out one of my son's friends is working. I just found this out last night. He's working part time as a Living Social. As a Living Social salesperson. So I think a lot of them are also part-time folks that just sell at night.
What do you think? You think this is going to work?
I think it'll probably work, yeah.
Yeah, it's a great idea. Yeah. I mean, it's nice to see things like that that are innovative and, you know, people that are thinkers and creators do well.
It is. Very,
yep.
Very
I
true.
Think the other thing that he's created that we need to do is we need to have an ice cream cooler in here, don't you think, Doug?
I think, you know.
We need to talk to the
program
director.
We need an ice cream cooler in this studio.
Absolutely. It will help us think better and perform better.
Yes.
You're listening to Tech Talk on one of these fine radio stations, WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick. We'll be right back in just a moment.